ladies and gentlemen, veterans of all ages, welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. Well, you know, hey, that respect is sort of boiling all over our nation right now. There's a brand new Clint Eastwood movie out there called American Sniper. It's based on real-life American Sniper and everything else. This movie is breaking all box office records. It's going on. The neat thing about it, and I've read both the movie, and I've seen the movie twice already, and I've read the book a couple times, it's based on fact. I mean, the correspondence, correlation between the book and the movie is astonishing, and it's out there for real. So let's talk about this a little bit tonight. Let's talk about military combat and what a sniper is and what's happening, and then bring in the PTSD issues. Over the last few radio shows, we've had two incredible authors. Ray Clark, who was U.S. Marine in Vietnam back in the 68 and 69, and Ruth Crocker, who lost her husband, who was a company commander. And if you haven't heard those shows, go back into the archives on PRN.FM and please listen to them. They're incredible. Well, today Ray is back with us. We're going to continue to have our conversation. Ray, welcome back to Warrior Connection.
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I'm glad to have you. I mean, you and I met, and I'm not sure how it all happened, but we're kind of becoming brothers, even though we've never met. We've been talking and working together and learning from each other.
Yeah,
I mean, this new movie, Sniper, I mean, it is based on hardcore reality, isn't it?
It is. It is. It really delves into a lot of emotional parts that you don't normally see.
Heard about him before. Obviously, all of us in the military have heard about him and heard about his legendary activities and what he did to protect the troops over there in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, I mean, he's sitting out there and picking off the enemy before the enemy gets us, whether they're laying bombs or putting off a mine or shooting somebody or whatever. I mean, he's kind of like the sniper's kind of like a guardian angel, isn't he?
Yeah, he really is. He really is. And it's fearful when the enemy has a sniper out there and you don't know where he's at. So they really create a lot of fear with the troops out. So they're very, they're very valuable for what they do.
I mean, we got to remember, we're not the only country that has this. I mean, the best sniper, the most legendary sniper in all of world history was a Soviet woman during World War II, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. They still have the rifle they used in those activities of, I can't remember where it was now. It wasn't Berlin. I mean,
it's a Model 38 and a 7.62 by 54R, which
right.
is basically identical to our 308 or our 7.62 NATO round.
Okay, yeah.
So they're both identical, I mean, very identical weapons, and they're all based, going back way back, you know, based on the same rifle, the German rifle. So
right.
What can you say? I mean, you know, when you got something that's so good, you don't mess with it. Well,
that's
you know, when we're talking about a sniper and all this stuff that happened in PTSD, when you're going into combat, the movie shows all this stuff, the guys moving out there, and they're kind of moving in a bunched-up cluster. And there's been, the police today are taking it, and the military kind of moving together in clusters. In real combat, to live and survive, you didn't move in clusters, did you?
No, we were constantly telling each other to spread out, keep distance between you, because, you know, it may be a sniper, but he may have an automatic rifle, and so he can take out three or four guys if you cluster up like that. So it was something you had to be conscious of all the time. And we were constantly reminding each other to, you know, be quiet and separate and stay away from each other. You never knew when somebody was going to take a shot at you.
Yeah, and then shotguns, I mean, just a single 12-gauge shotgun, buckshot, I mean, if you're all clustered together, you're in deep duty real fast.
That's true. That's very true.
I think one of the hard things, and all of us have worn flak jackets, I don't know, whatever they call them today, I mean, the old Vietnam era and Desert Storm era flak jacket we all wore is now given rise to all this new armor that fits
right.
in pockets and hangs all over you. But
right.
the bad thing about wearing all this stuff is when you got to get down in the dirt and get into a hole that you got to dig with your fingertips when you're wearing all this stuff, you can't get out of the way, can you?
No, I almost feel like they overdo it sometimes. Body armor is wonderful and it has helped, but it's not, I mean, a lot of it's up to you. You've got to use your head, you've got to stay down, you've got to do certain things. So, if it's, they carry 100 pounds of gear with them, it really limits what they can do sometimes.
Well, that's one of the things. I mean, in the sniper, Chris Kyle, in his book, he talks about all the gear they were carrying. And we know today there's an incredible amount of spinal injuries in all the troops, both the cervical and the lumbar spine and, you know, the thoracic spine, but carrying all of these incredible loads into combat. And it's kind of like sometimes, you know, I look at that movie, and there was a movie out there some time ago, you know, about the British and everything, and the guy says to her, well, I didn't get all dressed up not to have a fight, you know.
True. But, you know, the enemy's out there, and he's got a rifle, and he's got some bullets, and that's about all he's got, a little bag of rice or something like that, or whatever they eat nowadays. But that's all it takes sometimes. I mean, it's great that we have all the mechanics and all the instruments. I mean, they can, you know, we just think a sniper goes out there and just starts shooting people, but it's a real specialty that they do. They're professionals. And, you know, they are trained on different weapons. They practice marksmanship constantly. They train in concealment. That's a big deal, too, because if they're found, they die. And usually they die a hard death because people hate snipers. But they have, you know, Doug, they have professional spotters with them. They have computers with GPS. They have distance finders to show how far the enemy is from you. Instruments on finding the temperature and the wind direction and wind speed and humidity. All those things are very valuable tools if you're going to shoot somebody 500, 600, 800 yards away. You know, you can, if you, probably a one-inch miss here would constitute about a three-foot miss when you get to your target. So they have to be very good at what they do.
Well, when you're talking about just a single minute of angle, I mean, most people, and again, conventional marksman says, well, I have a rifle that shoots within 1 minute of angle. Well, that means that, you know, you've got a radius of, you know, 1 inch out there to 100 yards. You go to 200 yards, you got 2 inches. You go 300 yards, you got 3 inches. And that's where the rifle, if everything is absolutely perfect on the rifle, and the rifle is locked into a cradle where that rifle is going to shoot. That has nothing to do with the what you as an individual are going to shoot.
That's right.
And so you start putting all this stuff in there, and again, when all of we've learned marksmanship and you've been on this thing, most combat, and again, you know, we're picking on this, and I'm so thankful that you've been willing to talk about this and all this stuff. Most combat happens within a few yards, doesn't it?
It does. You know, the biggest thing about combat, I think, with us, was the difference. We had to be spontaneous. We had to be instantaneous. And a lot of our targets would pop right up, you know, 20 yards, 30 yards, 40 yards, very far, probably not much further than that at all. And so you had to make a instantaneous decision and then shoot your, where a sniper, most of the time, he has time to formulate all of his clicks and everything and decide which target he wants to take out first and all these things. Being out there in grunts or infantry, you don't have that option. You have to take the target as it appears, and hopefully you can get him before he gets you.
Yeah, I mean, you're starting to talk about it, these distances, the amount of time that's involved the person can run at you and get up to you, you know,
right,
when you're at 10 or 20 yards or 30 yards, and the amount of time it takes to manipulate a gun of some type or draw a pistol out of a holster.
Right.
So, I mean, this gets all to be pretty downright frightening. I mean, with these snipers today, I mean, obviously the current sniper rifle, the Model 24, is based on the Remington 700 again, which is goes back to based on the Mauser, which is all these sniper rifles are based on that Mauser from the turn of the 1900. But, I mean, these things are such perfect rifles that they've got everything lined up. You've got a scope on top of them. You've got adjustable cheek pieces. You've got adjustable trigger pull and stock and everything else. So these things are totally adjusted for the individual, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They're custom fit to them because they want the rifle to be part of the individual. They're one, you know, and so that's his main function in life. You know, when I was looking at Chris Kyle, I was also thinking about Carlos Hathcott in Vietnam. He had 93 kills, I think it was, and in Vietnam. But there was a little bit of difference because Chris was in a lot of urban warfare, and he was on some other, you know, larger terrain areas. But Hathcock operated mostly in open terrain, And he would go out in his ghillie suits and all this stuff, and he spotter with him, and they'd stay out there for days or weeks hunting somebody down. So they had to be very careful. But, you know, Chris had a little bit more, maybe more opportunities presented itself than Hathcock had. I'm sure both of them took out as many as they could, because every time they take out one of them, they're basically saving the lives of Americans. And, we discussed that too, Doug, about what you did, and you probably dropped bombs on hundreds or thousands. I did what I could where I was. And, we did it because we are peacemakers, and we were trying to bring peace to a part of the world. And we were trying to get rid of the bad guys. So I think both of them were really trying to take out everybody they could. It's just the different locations and geographical areas.
I think that's a big difference. But again, we're looking to combat. If we're looking at combat in the open fields or something, or in the jungle and everything, versus into a mount area, operations, in urban terrain, in other words, all around houses and buildings and everything else, that's completely different. Right. I mean, Chris Kyle in his story, obviously, was some stuff out there, in mountaintop to mountaintop.
Oh, yeah.
But most of the stuff in the story and in the movie, this is all taking place where he's sitting on top of one building or inside a building trying to protect the guys running down the street ahead of him as they start doing their military operations. I mean, that's got to be a lot of responsibility. You're sitting up there to protect the guys. The guys don't know what they're going to get into. And you've got a limited area of visibility in what we'll call a range or an area to shoot in, don't you?
Yeah, and the higher you get up, the more visibility you have. So he probably saw them coming from different directions toward those Americans. So you have to prioritize and do a lot of figuring it out of who you need to take out first. You know, they used to say, there was a guy in my company that supposed to have had the longest shot in Vietnam. I forget how many 1,000 yards or so that he fired it. But he said that when he fired that rifle, he put the scope on the guy, and he raised the scope up, and he couldn't even see the guy. And when he fired it, it hit the guy in the neck and killed him. So a lot of these things are probably, they're doing it spontaneously. They're reaching out there. They're trying to get the first one that's going to get to the Americans. They're probably scrambling to find the second one. And I know it's a nerve-wracking situation when you're trying to take an enemy out like that, and you don't know where they're going to show up next. So I know that Chris had a lot of emotional trauma probably from just being able to see what was going up so far above, where the guys on the ground couldn't see it, he could.
Yeah, I think all of us have got that problem. Again, whether you're a medic or a sniper or a squad leader, platoon leader, you got to look out for your family and take care of your family first. And so
sure.
Chris is a guardian angel. Anybody who's been in a guardian angel, they're obviously out there to save lives. And in the movie, at the end of the movie, and the same thing in the book, Chris's main thing when he gets to this, the military psychiatrist or whatever, social worker, his own concern was, well, I couldn't save enough lives. I couldn't save all of these lives.
Right.
I mean, when you go to battle, I know in my own cases, I've never been into, direct firefight or hand-to-hand combat, thank God, but it's been around all the other junk. But you got the exhilaration of combat. At the same time, you got this incredible fear of combat.
Yeah.
But then when you come back home, this all crashes around you, doesn't it?
It does. It's an emotional. Well, that when the adrenaline pumps, like in a firefight, you're running, you're jumping, you're rolling, you're shooting, you're doing all these things. But when it's over with, you just crash. You just almost slump down and you want to go to sleep because you have exhilarated so much energy that, you're just wiped out. Well, the same thing in a sense when you come back home, when you put it down. And I think some of the PTSD problems of the day is when these guys are coming back home, they've been in those adrenaline-pumping situations, and all of a sudden they're coming back home, and they're having to calm down. They're having to shut down, and it's a lack of excitement that they have to get used to because they have been through a lot of excitement. And then it goes into depression and loneliness and all those type of things.
Well, that adrenaline rush is staggering. I know for my own case, when we were on the B-52 and we had something going wrong at the end of the runway,
right.
We knew we had to have that B-52 bombing system repaired and optimized because thousands of lives depended upon us dropping a proper load in what we called a bucket.
Right.
And if we couldn't get that done, it all fell apart. And so the bomb nav hard hat, what I was involved in, and whether you're a medic, when I was a medic in the infantry for 3 years, we had the same thing.
Right.
You're sitting there at the height of your game. You've got your brain totally in function. You've got everything together. You've got every sense in full operation, 100 and 200% reliability and capability. And one of the neat things, again, I don't know what I saw in everything in all my years, is the individual you really wanted to want around is a guy that was under the incredible stress and problems became calm as a clam in the mud.
Yeah, that's true. That is really true. And, you know, I talk about anomaly in my book about how the fear grows and grows and grows, and all of a sudden it calms down, and what you do is you become so focused on the enemy that you forget how scared you are. And so you calm down. And I think that's what happens to a lot of guys in combat. You say, well, they kept their head. Well, they did, but they probably went through some panic attacks too. But they were able to sit there and process it and get over it and go on and do whatever had to be done.
Well, I think one of the big differences of talking to, you know, our father's generation, they were in World War II, and then we got, you know, older cousins or, you know, maybe some uncles that were in Korea.
Right.
But again, in that case, the enemy was well-defined. You had defined battle lines. You had defined, here's the enemy, here's the good guys, here where we're at, and everything was well-defined. When you got over to Vietnam, and whether we were in Thailand or no matter where we were, we still had the bad guys all around us, and in Vietnam, you never knew where you were and who the bad guys were and who the good guys were, did you?
No, especially down south in Vietnam. Now, I was up in the northern part of South Vietnam, and up there we fought mainly the North Vietnamese Army, so we could tell them by their uniforms.
So you were fighting primary regular North Vietnamese military personnel.
They were what they called hardcore. Well, I hope they called us hardcore, too, because we did the same thing. But we were fighting, you know, like companies and battalions of them and all that. Down south, it was dealing with a lot of civilian warriors or civilian soldiers.
That was the term, you know, the Viet Cong, correct?
Yeah, that was the Viet Cong. And the same thing in today in Iran, Iraq, and those places like that. You can't tell the enemy. I watched movies. I watched one not long ago called Locker. I forgot what it was called. Hurt Locker. And, you know, they were out there talking and laughing and carrying on, and all of a sudden they walk off and an IED blows off, kills people. And so that was the problem that they have over there. I don't know how their adrenaline ever quits pumping, Doug, because if you have to keep a certain mentality of not getting too serious, because if you do, it will just overtake you. You will probably crawl up in a corner and hide. You have to be able to function in that. And with the adrenaline pumping like it is, when they come back, they're having lots of problems. And you're going 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 tours of duty. And I think the reason for that is because it's like a family. They have developed a family. They got a family at home. They got a family in the military. When that family goes back over for another tour, they naturally want to be with them.
Yeah, I mean, that concept of family. You and I have talked a little bit about that, and both of us understand this concept of family.
Right.
You've got two families. You've got your family, who is your military buddies, and then you've got your biological and physiological family, who is back home, or maybe in some cases, I mean, in recent wars, I know we went to Desert Storm. We had, you know, several husband and wife teams in the same units or adjoining units.
Right.
But that was so strange. But those are totally distinct things. So you're in a military, you're in a warrior, you're hopped up, you've had multiple deployments, you're in and out of battles and everything. That family that you have around you takes all priority of everything, because life depends on each other, doesn't it?
Yes, sir, it does. It really does. I mean, it's really good cohesion. But also with that, and you're in dangerous situations, when you lose one or two or three or four of them, it's like losing somebody in your own biological family. The pain is no less. And so, you know, with all the good things, you always have consequences that go with it, Doug. And that's what a lot of guys suffer from is survivor guilt, those type of things. And I think Chris probably suffered a lot of survivor guilt because he saw the guys dying sometimes from up on a second, third-story building looking through a hole. And he probably saw a lot of things that he could probably never even find the words to tell it.
So, when we look at the weapon systems he have, obviously, you know, he's talking about different weapon systems. Sometimes he had the M4 or the M16. You know, basically that's a 5.56 round.
Right.
And again, it's a 22 caliber round, the historic round that everybody's been using. Again,
yeah.
When we look at all this stuff, the ballistics on a 5.56 round is a 22 caliber round. So, I mean, this thing is really good within 100 or maybe 150 yards.
Right.
But you get out beyond 250 yards, out to 300 yards, the ballistics on this thing, no matter what you do, when you fire that bullet's going to drop 2 feet, isn't it?
It will drop, but now they do use M16 on 500-yard targets, Camp Lejeune and places like that. Now, they probably crank it way up and everything else to get it out there, but they do they fire 200, 300, and 500 yards, and they're basically shooting at silhouette targets or something like that. We did a lot of pop-up targets where you walk down a trail and a target would pop up and you shoot them, boom, 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 and you keep walking. And that was getting you used to the instantaneous. But you talk about the projectile, too. Projectile on an M16 bullet, a 223, will tumble. And once it leaves the barrel, it goes a certain distance and it starts tumbling. And the way that bullet is tumbling, whatever direction it is pointing when it hits you, it goes down, goes up. It does a lot of damage because it's not just going into you. It is ripping stuff. And if it hits a bone and it's the point is pointed down when the projectile hits the person, then that bullet will travel down that bone and follow the bone and come out the foot somewhere.
Well, that's because, the 226 round, that's only a 60-grain bullet. When we look at the 300 Winchester Mag, which is what Chris Kyle is using, or the 308, which is 7.62 NATO,
right?
I mean, those are 180-grain rounds. I mean,
they're
three times as much mass as that 5.56 round, so it's a massive amount of energy. And the same thing, the 5.56 is a small bullet, so, I mean, it's a flat-shooting gun, and the reason it's so accurate is because the rifle was designed to become one with you. In other words, the stock is lined up with the, you know, everything lined up just in a perfect line.
Exactly.
So it's a lot more accurate. You don't have all the other physics there to worry about. But still, the energy of that 5.56 round drops off really low after 200, 250 round, 200 yards, 300 yards, which is a reason that... he's using that 300 Winchester Mag, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I mean, you want as much power to get it out there, and you want it when it hits. It just don't punch a hole, but it really it hits you, and the flesh, the meat and everything almost turns to jelly. It hits so hard. It's really a very destructive projectile. In 1967, when I was at Camp Lejeune, our company was at the we had to qualify. We went to the range, and we were shooting M14s, which was a 308. And I shot second highest on the range that week. But we spent 4 days, all day long, targeting, you know, strapped in, what they called it, where you do certain things with a sling, and you tighten it up. And really, you are in a tight position that when you pull the trigger, you may go back, but you come forward again. And, I mean, these, you know, when they pull the trigger on that thing, it's not just somebody like a deer hunter. These guys are out there, and they're locked in on you, and they're going to be able to hit those targets. They won't be wasting a whole lot of ammunition. So,
I'm looking at the ballistics for a 300 Winchester Mag, the 180-grain round, which is the primary round for this stuff. If you zero that in at 200 yards, We got the 250 yards. I mean, it's about dropped already 2.5 inches. You get out to 300 yards, that thing has dropped on down to 6 inches. We get out to 400 yards, this thing has dropped 17 inches. And we get out to 500 yards, this thing has dropped 3 feet. I mean,
this
is without taking in consideration. So if you're on a flat plane, that bullet's going to drop no matter what. I mean, then you've got to figure out how high up and how low down are you and where are you going to put this position on. So
well,
you know, the ballistics of this thing is astonishing. So when you talk about a sniper, it seems as it talked about in the book and in the movie and as you're putting it out there, most sniper shots are taken at what, 100, maybe 200 yards, maybe 300 yards max?
Well, I mean, they do a mile now with a 50 caliber. No, they crank them on out there, you know, 300, 400, 500, 600 yards. But what they do, Doug, is that they put them on the range all the time. What we would do, we'd have at 200 yards, the target's at 200 yards with a 308 M14. We would find all, you know, the windage, the elevation, all these type of things, how many clicks it was. Every time you click it, it would go up a little bit. You click the dial, it goes up or down or side. And so you write down that windage and elevation, and then you move up to a 300 yard, and then you do the same thing. You walk it up, and then you write down how many clicks up and down, and then you go to 500 yards, and so you do the same thing. So every day you're honing in on those certain coordinates. The day of the you know, when you go out to be tested, you had the coordinates already written down in the book. And so when I sit down at 200 yards, I put 3 clicks to the left and 4 clicks up to the right, depending on the wind or whatever it was that day. And you could be right on your target. Out of all the targets I fired that day, I don't know how many it was, probably 100 bullets, I only missed probably about 3 or 4 times the entire day. I missed a bullseye.
So what you're talking about, though, is these individuals that fire these rifles so much that they have all the ballistics down pat. They're top-notch, I guess we'd just call them physicists almost.
Yeah.
And they know where that bullet's going to go. And so when using the scope or the iron sights, they can turn in these adjusted clicks so they know where they need to move their sights to shoot at that specific distance, don't they?
Yeah, they do, and they have computers on board with them. They have instruments for telling them how much the wind is blowing and what direction it is and the humidity and all these things that do affect, you know, the bullet itself, the projectile. So with all the instrumentation they have nowadays in their computers, it's really sitting there and, you know, working out the strategy of what you need to do. And then once you get it, you probably, the first shot would come within a very, your spotter is watching, so he would be able to say, come up 3 clicks or go over right 4 clicks or whatever he would say. But you should be in the neighborhood by the time you pull that trigger.
Yeah, so that's quite a bit
really
of difference. But you're talking about a team effort, aren't you?
It is, and it's a science almost with these guys because they're killing an enemy over a mile away now with a sniper rifle.
Yeah, but again, but most of the stuff, again, they talked about in the movie and everything, most of this stuff is done within a couple hundred yards because you can't see out to those distances. I mean, we got to come down to the realistic how much you do it.
Sure. The urban warfare is house to house, and he's probably 3 or 4 houses down. He's shooting people coming out of the house or something. So, yeah, it would just vary. Probably every situation is different, but the adrenaline is pumping. And they get back, and, you know, they high-five everything, and the grunts are thanking them, and they're having a big old time. When you come home, it's like going from color television to black and white. You know, you come home, and it just lacks color, you know. Life just seems really boring when you come back. And I'm sure they probably want to get back over there. It's probably very satisfying, too. Doug, you know the missions you flew and the things that you did. It was very satisfying to think that you were making a very big mark on history and the war by doing your job. These guys, I'm sure they're doing the same thing. And as a grunt, I mean, there was a lot of satisfaction. There was a, you know, it's a different world, but yet you're in this together with a lot of people.
When you're like that in your grunt in your family, that family becomes one, isn't it? I mean,
it really does.
You're dependent upon your food and everything, where you're going to house, how you're going to sleep, what you're going to get done in that small family, your squad or your company, you know, I mean, whatever level you're functioning on.
Yeah, but, that's right, everything.
So you're together with all these guys, and I know in Vietnam when we got shipped in and out by individual basis, we had a one-year rotation. You know, I did 18 months, but I was in a special group. But
right.
Most people, they go over there for 6 months or they go over there 12 months, so they're rotating in and out. Unlike World War II or Korea, where they rotated out as an entire unit.
That's right.
And then now with this latest one, I mean, they're both rotating in and out as individuals, but they're rotating in and out with units.
Yeah.
I mean, how does that all come into play? I mean, you've got your family that you're with and your life dependent, your adrenaline rush is all there. Then you come back home. And now all of your responsibilities have shifted. I know when I went to Desert Storm, I came back and the responsibilities have shifted. I found out, hey, they got along fine without me.
Yeah, that's probably a shocker when you come to realize that. But, you know, when I went in, it was individual. We went into a unit that was already there. They were out in the bush. And when I came in, one of the old guys, it was his time to leave. So you lost the company lost a lot of experience when that, you know, old salt left, and then they got me and they started had to train me. But they thought that was a lot better than bringing a whole new unit in and having to train a whole new unit. So what you did was you kept up the proficiency of the company by bringing individuals in and training them with the older guys, and it just kept it at a high level of proficiency. But it didn't do a whole lot for camaraderie because, you know, the guy's here today and gone tomorrow. And it just, but, you know, most guys, Doug, didn't ever do the 12-month rotation. They always got wounded or killed before they ever got there. Or they were shipped somewhere else, you know. So there was a lot of emotional struggles along with that. I don't know which is better to do unit wise or rotation wise, but I'm sure the politicians will figure that one out.
So, I mean, yourself, after you had that horrible day on Muta's Ridge and everything in that time frame, I mean, your unit, you thought you guys were all coming home and your unit got disbanded. You guys got shipped all over to different units, didn't you?
That's true. I mean, it was kind of a disappearing in plain sight. That's what it came down to. First Marines needed replacements because they'd taken so many casualties. We were scheduled to come home, 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines, but at the very last minute, they said, well, you're going to go down and fill the ranks of the 1st Marines. You're not 3rd Marines anymore, you're 1st Marines.
How many do you have any idea to this day, how many survived those battles in your company that got moved on?
I don't know, but I have seen 3 or 4 on the wall that did die after we split up. I saw their names on there. So I don't know, have any idea, but I know just by, you know, what was always happening, probably a lot of them got wounded and messed up. Maybe not died, but I did know some of them had died. And the thing was, Doug, they did bring our flags home, for our battalion flags and all these things, all the logistics part and everything. It did come back to the States. It was the grunts who stayed in Vietnam. And what happened was when they had celebrations and parades of our unit coming back to from Vietnam, it was other Marines marching with those flags. It wasn't us. It was a big celebration, but we were still in Vietnam, all over Vietnam.
So, I know the same thing happened in Desert Storm. The unit I was with originally came home, and they kept me over to do the Friendly Fire Project, and then I came back all over myself, had a report in the commanding general, went into Pagonis and said, okay, hey, I'm done. I got the stuff ready to ship back, and okay, go get on an airplane and fly home. So I came back all by my lonesome.
Yeah.
Now, when you come back, your family that you've been with and dependent upon, this is all broken up. Now you're going back to your regular family. What
right.
kind of problems are happening? I mean, in the movie and in the book with Chris Kyle, it shows all over. I mean, really good. I mean, the movie has done a very good job of showing the conflict with his real, his, you know, biological family and his wife and his kids.
Oh, yeah. You know, I wrote something in the book about the killing part of it. And I know Chris said, you know, he had no problem with killing. And I don't say I did either, and you probably don't either. I mean, we were there to do that, and that's what it was. But I said something in the book about, as strange as it sounds, and even though the NBA were our enemy, it seemed with everyone we ruthlessly killed, a little of us died with them. That kind of guilt only comes from being a young American that was raised to have morals and principles of decency and integrity. No country in this world like America, and the young men and women we send to fight for freedom in a hostile world are the best we have. Killing our enemy was right, but the way we killed them was at times immoral.
So this is where you're talking about. This might be this thing that they're coming up discussion now, moral injury then, isn't it?
Exactly. I think so, too. And what it is when you've been in that kind of situation, you know, with Chris, you know, you, where are you going to shoot the guy? You're going to shoot for mass. You're going to shoot him in the chest. You're going to shoot him in the head. When you do shoot, you're going to see things explode and things really get, you know, messy. Well, he's still looking through the scope, so he's going to see it all. And, you know, I think with everybody that has any integrity and morals or anything else, when you have to do that kind of job, it's going to take a toll on you. There's two things that really affect a man. One of them is killing people creates a heavy burden. And the other thing is being hunted by armed people creates a heavy burden.
In other words, you're the animal that's being hunted all the time.
Yeah, you have to kill the enemy before he kills you. And so you become animalistic if you want to, or you just, I said in the book that we had to become as complacent as a corner butcher working on a piece of beef. We had to develop a mental hardness that allowed us to do things that we knew we'd always been taught not to, but that was our job, and that's how we stayed alive, was killing the ones who were trying to kill us. And so when Chris came home, it shows in the movie and in the book that how he was affected by that. He may not have been able to put a finger on what he was feeling, but that moral injury will, it's a way deep inside, and it makes you feel a little bit unclean. It makes you feel a little bit shameful. It makes you, I mean, you did everything you could. You just wish you'd done a better job at it.
And, I mean, we hear over and over again, and this goes back to antiquity, and we've heard it today and again, the guy comes back from a deployment, and he wants to get back for another deployment because he kind of felt like, well, hey, I need to be over there. I'm the best, or there's nobody else can do my job. I mean, all of us have had that in our ego where, hey, we're the best. We got to be there. There's nobody else can do our job, when in reality, there's a lot more out there, isn't there?
Oh, there are. There's always somebody better and somebody more available. I remember when I had malaria and I came back off of the hospital ship, and they gave me 3 days, and then they sent me back to the company for 3 days. My company was, I mean, to the rear area. My company had been ambushed 5 days in a row, and they'd taken a lot of casualties. And I had 3 days of sick leave that I could have just laid around for 3 days. I wanted to get back out there in the bush. I felt responsible. I felt like I could contribute. And those guys needed every, experienced Marine they could get hold of. So I jumped back on a chopper and went back out there. And once I got out there, I thought, I must be out of my mind. What am I doing here? Because it was really bad. But it's something in all of us, I think, with that family situation, that you want to be with them and you feel like you can contribute something. Doug, I don't know if it's about being the best or not, but it is being one of the best, maybe. And you said before when we talked, the problem with being the best is there's always somebody that wants to take out the best. You know, they have a bounty on all the, I'm sure Chris had a bounty, Carlos Hathcock had bounties on him. All of them have bounties. These other countries are, you know, sending other snipers in to kill this guy. That's what they did in the Soviet Union, in Russia in World War II. The Germans were having so many snipers in there and that the Russians started fighting back, and then the Germans sent in their best sniper to kill that Russian sniper. and the Russian sniper was able to take him out. There was a movie about that, about the snipers around.
So what happened when the guy comes back? I mean, you're coming back out of a military operation, whatever you've done. You've been involved in killing. Maybe you got wounded or injured yourself. You're seeking medical care. I mean, as you know, and I mean, we've been working on it, we're still having individuals who are having a frustration time trying to get medical care. Slowly, we're getting that door broken down. But so you're coming out. You've had this adrenaline rush. Now you're coming back where you have to settle and calm down. You've got something on the side of the road, or you've got something that doesn't look right, and you're sitting there hypered out looking for things around you. I mean, this has got to affect your wife and your children and everything, doesn't it?
It really does. It affects everybody around you, and they end up, you know, the people who supported you the most end up being collateral damage. They talk about Vietnam veteran marriages are over 90%, something like 94% divorce rate.
Because say that again?
94% divorce rate.
From the people that were married when they went to Vietnam and when they came back?
Well, the people who came back and got married, that's the divorce rate of Vietnam veterans.
Wow.
And I know veterans that have been married 8 and 9 times. So, you know, it's a terrible situation. And what it is, you're trying to live a halfway normal life, but you've got this never-ending war that can just hangs on to you. And so many things remind you of it that, you know, when I'd go out hunting, and I was trying to reconnect with Vietnam, and then by the time I get back home, I'd be a nervous wreck, and then my wife and children would be the recipients of my irritability.
I mean, that irritability can sometimes control, but we've got, as you already mentioned, the suicide rates are astronomical.
Yeah.
Child and spouse abuse has been way too high. I mean, it seems like there's a real problem. You send the veteran, the military guy, off to combat or whatever it is. They come on back, and they're kind of left in abandoned, dropped on the doorstep, and nobody knows how to deal with it or how to help the individual. And then the guy gets totally flustered because he can't get his medical care, or when he has a bad day, he might have a bad day one day and have a real good day the next day, but he's just looking for some, I don't know how you call it, understanding or compassion. What is it really there that's missing?
I think we have to learn that the guy is going to be different when he comes home. We have to be looking for the different things. We have to not cater to him, but understand the problem. And the VA has some helps that wives can go to the VA, and they'll put them through classes so they can understand post-traumatic stress a little bit better. But the guy is going to be dealing with survivor's guilt, which brings on depression. He's going to be dealing with adrenaline pumps, which causes hypertension. If you're not careful, he's going to try to self-medicate. He's going to make bad choices. He's going to have negative friends and entertainment that is really causing him more problems. And substance use and abuse. You know, it's a thing of self-medicating where he wants to feel better. He doesn't want to remember and all these things, but it doesn't work like that. And one problem runs into another one. You know, a DWI nowadays, driving with alcohol, it would cost you about $10,000. And that's just another hole into the finances of the family.
Yeah, and all this stuff is coming together. So, I mean, it's just like, it's a mess that somehow we've got to figure out, because if we're going to continuously get involved in wars, continually send these young kids off to war, when they come back, we have to have something put in place where they're taken care of. But, I mean, like this one individual we've been working with, Denise and I and others have been working, we got congressional help and everybody got help within the VA. This guy couldn't get his proper care at a VA in Pennsylvania. And we had to yank chains every which way but loose, and we finally got him where they agreed to give him his care, you know, on late Friday and into Saturday, and then emailed today that the doctor had given the referral he needed to the Warren's Clinic in Washington. But if the individual is sick and he doesn't feel good, or he's got a psychological problem or a physiological problem, he really does have a problem where the doctor or the family needs to listen to that and help them, don't they?
They really do. And one of the problems is, Doug, a lot of times the guys who deserve it the most will be the last to ask for it. And so they want to fix it themselves, or they want to deny they even have a problem. The only thing I could come up with for many, many years was I deserved it. I deserved what I got. And I want to tell you something. This is on international radio, but I want to tell you this. I used to ride my motorcycle, and I would spit in the wind just to spit back in my face because I couldn't stand me. I hated me. And it came out of Vietnam, and I had to reconcile that. I had to get that fixed. And I think there's a lot of guys that do the same things. They almost hate themselves because they were forced into situations, and they did the best they could. But when they came out, a lot of times people and things, and, you know, Michael Moore said something about, you know, snipers were a bunch of cowards and all this kind of stuff. He better hope he never goes up against one, you know, because I don't think they're cowards.
Better watch out for Jesse Ventura.
It's true. But these guys are the best we have. These men and women we're sending over there, and when they come back, they're wounded. They are hurt, and they need somebody just to reach out. I work with an organization called Boots on the Ground. And it's a suicide prevention for veterans. And I got a call today from a friend of mine that works with suicide prevention, and he told me, I started to call you the other day. He said, I was going to hang myself. And he said, I decided I wasn't going to call, and because of some reasons. But I said, don't ever hesitate, man. Doug, I guess as long as we live, we're going to have to deal with that. You won't ever get over PTSD, but you can find coping skills that'll help you live with it.
First off, you got to remember, don't go, you know, go on to alcohol and nicotine and street drugs. I mean, you got to use your prescribed medications as they're directed and not overuse them. But then you have to get relaxation and get another occupation or a job or do something productive, don't you?
You do. And I wrote that chapter in my book called Coping Skills, and it's things that I use in my life. I didn't put anything in there that I thought was needless or just taking up space. It was things that absolutely worked because I know, and it's helped me to get a degree of sanity and function in this world. And I've come out of a lot of it, but you know, I fight it every day. I still have to do the same coping skills myself that I tell other people about. And I told the guy that works with suicide, that was contemplating suicide himself, I told him the other day, I said, John, I said, what if you and I commit suicide? What's that message going to be sent to the people we keep telling, don't do it, don't do it? And he told me today, he said, you know, I thought what you said, and it stopped me from hurting myself. So sometimes, Doug, we just have to get more information. We have to learn how to cope. We have to learn, and our families have to help us with this thing. They're going to have to cope with it too. But if we can do it more like a family, if you're starting to drink and everything, let your family help you get off of that. Let your family help you quit spending all your money on certain things or whatever. Do it as a family. Let your family be what it's supposed to be, loving each other and helping each other. That military family is going to disappear. I mean, they're going to go away, and you're going to retire. You're going to do something. It's going to be gone. You might get injured, and you're going to have to live with the rest of these people for a long time, so you might as well learn how to get along with them.
And, can we go into another area? I mean, we've been talking about the military, but you had another chapter in your life, and this is really critical today. You were a police chaplain, correct, sir?
I was. Yeah, I was.
And the police and the fire and dealing with the police, they've got all the same thing as a military combat veteran has to deal with, don't they?
They do, but it's not on the scale, you know, of the military. And they do more interdiction, and they arrest people rather than shoot them. We would rather shoot them than arrest them. That's the difference.
You had no options there in the military.
Yeah, right. And today, I mean, here's the problem is, a police officer has to hesitate because he knows if he pulls that trigger, he's going to be scrutinized, he's going to be pulled off duty, he's going to be probably sued, he's going to be everything. So he will hesitate. The bad guy, when he goes in the room, he has already determined what he's going to do. He is ready to shoot. And so it's really a one-sided deal there. I had some officers, there was a shooting here in where I live at, a guy was running away, and he was a street thug. He never had a gun with him, but he'd been to prison. Well, this time he did have a weapon with him. And so when they were stopping him, there was four or five officers kind of picking at him and messing on him. And the guy took off running, and the two young police officers that were with this group of police officers, they ran after him because they were young and they were fit and everything. Well, the guy ran around the corner, pulled out the pistol. When they came around the corner, he opened fire on him, killed one and wounded another one. And
I mean, the bad guy did this to the police officers.
Yeah. The bad guy killed one officer and shot the other one, and the wounded officer shot the bad guy and killed him. Well, a week or so later, the officers called me and said, "Can you come and talk to us?" I said, "Yeah, I'd be glad to." And I went over to their house. There was a bunch of them there. And they said, "We don't know how to move on from this point on. How do we go? How do you lose friends and you feel so guilty about it because we didn't pat the guy down or something? And we just have all this guilt. What do we do? How do we move on from here?" And I was able to talk to them, because I've had to do that myself from Vietnam. I've had to move on. I'll never forget my buddies. I'll never not love my buddies. But I find it every day of my life. I learn coping skills, and I do them. And they do help me. The Vicks Nasonhaler is very good for me. I've told a lot of people about that. It does open up your sinuses so you get some oxygen to your brain. So there's a lot of tools out there. There's a lot of things in life that once it happens, it's done. I mean, it's not going to go away. We have to learn how to get around it. And there are tools. There are a lot of people that want to help these guys, but they're going to have to reach out for help. And
I think in the end of the movie and the end of the book, one of the most disturbing things about this, Chris Kyle and his buddy were trying to help another vet that was in trouble, and that obviously that guy murdered both of them. And when I'm looking at that and thinking about it, I have had other individuals ask me about that. It's almost like, you know, Wyatt Earp and John Wayne and Wild Bill Hickok, where Chris Kyle is the ultimate good guy and everything else, but the embodiment of the war. And this guy almost, in a sense, maybe was like, well, he's all the good and all the bad. Maybe if I get him, I'll be the top dog and everything else like this, or I can get rid of the problems that I'm see causing the problems or something. I mean, there's some weird thinking going on there, isn't there?
It is. And one thing, this is just my take, too. I think it's sometimes don't push these guys too early to get them to a rifle range because they love guns, because they've been to Iraq and Afghanistan. That may not be the best tool you can use for their help. I was at a range with a police department. And as I was walking away, this was out in the woods, but I was walking away, everybody opened fire, boom, 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 and it was just like a firefight. And I had a little bit of a panic attack right then, and so I had to get away from there. Well, you don't know how guys are going to react. They're coming back from those places, and maybe it was too early to get him into that, but it really turned out bad, and I'm so sorry for Chris and the other guy. We lost some good American guys, and you know, that always hurts. So, we'll just do what we can to try to get the other ones to receive help. Don't wait 35 years to do it. It won't be any better. You just have to carry the dead body around with you for all those years.
I think that's a big thing. I mean, everybody wants to be John Wayne and Rambo and your ego, and you try to get by with yourself without saying, hey, I do need help, and I'm going to go get the help from the pros from Dover, because they're definitely out there if you can find them and ask for help, aren't they?
There really are, Doug. The VA has been very good to me, and they have helped me. I try to be as friendly as I can to them. I thank them all the time for what they're doing for me, and it makes them want to help me even more. So I've had a pretty good experience with them. I've only had one life-threatening event that they dropped the ball, but I did live through it, so I'm all right now. But the other thing is, too, I don't want people, you're talking about tough guys and Rambos and all this stuff, I'm not even military. They watch the movie, they think, I want to be a sniper. And so that's what they want to do. You have to understand, these snipers are like SEALs and Green Beret and specialized training. They go through a lot to become a sniper. You just don't walk in and say, I can shoot good. These guys are very regimented. They are very disciplined. They have been tested in a multitude of ways. Most people have never been tested, and so they don't know what they'll do. Yeah, you can shoot good, but what happens when the other guy can shoot good? What if he opened fire on you? What are you going to do, throw it down and run or something? Or, you know, when the bullets are flying in your way, it's a whole different world. So I don't want people to watch a movie and say, oh, man, that's what I want to do. You know, and I want to be a sniper. I want to be a sniper. Well, it could end up bad, so don't do that. If you want to do that, join the police department. Try to get on to the super-duper squads and all that stuff and, you know, have a good time. But just don't take it on your own to try to be Chris Kyle, because it won't work.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to, even when you get into the military, I mean, before you even get to these situations, you've been tested and trained as psychological profile every which way but loose, aren't you?
You are. And you know, when I talked about the book about the NBA, they had been fighting on, say, Munner's Ridge and places like that for 50 years. And so they would pre-register their weapons in every situation. So they had it all covered. Wherever you went, they would have their mortars pre-registered or whatever it was, and they could drop them right on top of you. Well, these snipers and people like that, they do a lot of training. They do a lot of, scoping places out. They know where the enemy is going to go. They know where they're going to shoot him at. They know which one they're going to take out first. They say if there's three walking, you should be able to hit the last one before the first one ever hears the bullet fire at a distance like that. So they do a lot of training. It's not just a bunch of ragtag guys that can shoot well, but these guys are really disciplined and very honorable.
Well, it's been a really interesting conversation again, Ray. I mean, there's always some inside stuff to learn. Tell people how to get your book, the name of your book, and how to get your book here in the last second or so.
Okay. It's called The Never Ending War, and it's about unseen scars of post-traumatic stress. It's a combat memoir. It's written by L.M. Clark, and you can get it through Amazon, Books A Million, Barnes & Nobles, and my website, theneverendingwar.com.
So, well, thanks a lot, Ray. Everything you've been doing and helping this is really important. Thank you for coming on this program and giving us some insight and everything. Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to thank you again. Go see the movie. Read the book. Think about it, understand, get the lessons, and if you know anybody that's helped, as Ray and I have just said and Denise has said and everybody, please go get them help. That's a critical thing. If you need help, don't be Superman. Go get your help. Right, Ray?
That's right. Exactly.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you and have a good evening and good night.